Well, good afternoon, everybody. My name is... Do we have enough seats? My name is Rick Britton. I'm a local author and historian. The name of this program, the name of this event, is The Civil War Before, During, and After. I want to welcome you on behalf of the Virginia Foundation for the Humanities, producer of this great Virginia Festival of the Book. And here's something that's really important. Please take a moment now and silence your cell phones. So in other words, if it's an electronic device invented since the Civil War, please turn it off now. Unless it's a pacemaker, do not turn off your pacemakers. They're encouraging everybody to tweet some great things about this event. And if you do tweet, tweet at hashtag VABook2016. I have never tweeted, so I have no idea what that means. The festival is free of charge, not free of cost. Please remember to go online to give back or give up or give pick up a giving envelope from the information desk at the Omni, that's where the headquarters is, and support this festival so that we may sustain it for many more years. And I want to thank, too, before I forget, the City of Charlottesville for sponsoring the Festival of the Book and for providing this great venue. This is really one of the best in my estimation. This event, in case you're wondering, is being recorded for the broadcast, for broadcast on Charlottesville's own TV10, and we will be available online at www.charlottesville.org/TV10. If you're wondering what the second camera is, that's C-SPAN. If you have a question during the Q&A portion of the discussion about the last 15, 20 minutes or so, please raise your hand, wait for the microphone to come around so that everybody can hear you. Another thing that's really important, and I'm colorblind, so I called it a yellow sheet before, but please fill out those bright green program evaluations. They provide useful information that help keep the festival free and open to the public. You can fill out a paper evaluation before you leave, please, or you can complete it online at vabook.org/survey. And don't forget that immediately afterward, we're going to have a book signing. Now, without any further ado, what we're going to do is go in chronological order. So two doors down from me, to my left, gentleman is the author of The Peace That Almost Was, The Forgettable Story of the 1861, The Forgotten Story of the 1861. It's not forgettable because he wrote a book about it.
Welcome, Joe.
The Forgotten Story of the 1861 Washington Peace Conference and the Final Attempt to Avert Civil War. He's a lifelong Northern Virginian, and he publishes articles on history, faith, and political life. Please join me in welcoming Mark Tooley.
I'll go ahead right now. Yes. Thank you so much. It's a great honor to be here among such distinguished company, especially Dr. Robertson, who last year wrote a very generous blurb for my book, calling it The Definitive History of the Washington Peace Conference. Of course, there's been only one other book on that topic, so it hasn't been a lot of competition. But in fact,
that was the forgettable book.
That was the forgettable. Unfortunately, it was a very good book, but it was 60 years ago, so I thought it was time for an update. The Washington Peace Conference has largely been forgotten, so it wasn't completely a slip of the tongue. Obviously, it was overshadowed by subsequent events, but it's in and of itself, it's very important. It's one that I've been at least somewhat aware of almost my whole life, growing up in the Washington area, often walking down Pennsylvania Avenue near the White House by the old Willard Hotel, which is still there, although not the same building as was there 160 years ago. But there's still a big plaque out front saying this is the site that the Washington Peace Conference of February 1861, where they deliberated, trying to identify some alternative to disunion and civil war. And I guess my awareness of the Peace Conference revived in recent years, especially with debates over the Confederate flag and discussions over what really was the origination of the Civil War. Was it slavery or something else? And to my vague recollection at this Washington Peace Conference, the only thing they talked about, and certainly the only proposals they came up with, all related to slavery. They didn't discuss the tariff or any other issue. So that seemed to be pretty important, and no one seemed to be talking about that. So let me, in 20 minutes, tell you what the Washington Peace Conference was all about. It began on February 4th, 1861, on a cold Washington winter day. There were about 2 inches of snow outside, and eventually about 131 delegates would come to the conference at the Willard Hotel. It had been the brainchild of an old statesman who had been retired for a decade and a half at that point, a Virginian, former President John Tyler. And like many, or at least several participants of the Washington Peace Conference, he was literally a son of one of the founders. His father had been governor of Virginia, and his father had been a good friend of Patrick Henry. Tyler himself, I didn't put in the book because I couldn't pinpoint it exactly, but I'm almost certain as a child he must have met George Washington. Certainly as a young man, he knew James Madison. He knew Thomas Jefferson. And so he had, in his mind, justifiably a vested interest in trying to preserve the Republic. And so in the secession winter of early 1861, he came forward in a Richmond newspaper letter or editorial. The country obviously being in crisis, six states having already seceded in the Deep South following Lincoln's election in November. And he proposed that there be a final effort, a peace conference, to try to adjudicate these differences to prevent a further disaster. His original idea was for it just to be the middle states, the upper South, the border states, and the lower North. But the Virginia legislature and the governor took up the idea and widened the proposal as an invitation to all willing states to come to Washington. And surprisingly, given the state of communications at that time, it all unfolded within a couple of weeks. So they were all there for the most part that first week of February. And very early on, the newspapers of the time, which covered this event extensively, began describing it as the old gentleman's convention, in that, at least by the standards of the time, it was a very relatively older crowd. And these were the senior statesmen of the day who literally had been running the country since the founding generation. They were sort of the generation in between the founders and the new rising Civil War generation. And this was sort of their last blast, their last attempt to hold the country together, which they had been successful at for the previous several decades. The cast of characters who are in my book, who are either at the convention or on the sidelines participating in some way, include Tyler himself, of course, his much younger wife, Julia, who comes with him to Washington, stays at Brown's Hotel with him on Pennsylvania Avenue, and writes some fascinating letters to her mother up in New York, describing what's going on at the Peace Conference. There's a the delegates include lots of former cabinet members, former representatives, former senators, former judges, the distinguished people of their day, and one former cabinet member, an old Whig named Hewing from Ohio. I'll mention him because he is the father-in-law of someone who would soon become very famous in his own right, William Tecumseh Sherman, father-in-law and stepfather. And so he's there as a delegate. One of the most outspoken of the Southern delegates and described as the most effective orator at the Washington Peace Conference is James Seddon, who would go on to be the one of the war secretaries in the Confederate government. There's a naval officer and former senator from New Jersey named Stockton, Commodore Stockton, and there's a wonderful story relating to him and John and Julia Tyler. Like almost all the characters in the book, these people have interconnected with each other for decades. And the connection between Stockton and Tyler's is that during Tyler's presidency 20 years before, he was a widower. He was out on an excursion on a U.S. naval vessel on the Potomac River one Sunday afternoon with much of official Washington called the USS Princeton. And the ship had an experimental artillery piece called the Peacekeeper. And it's fired off several times to the delight of the crowd. And before it returns to Washington, having gone down the river to Mount Vernon and back, it is fired off one final time. It explodes. And among the fatalities is a New York congressman whose daughter is below deck, Julia. And reputedly, according to legend, she faints back into the arms of the widower president, who carries her off the ship and marries her some months later. And she goes on to become the youngest ever first lady and one of the most fashionable.
How gallant of him.
Yes, it was very, very generous of him. Other characters include Roger Sherman Baldwin, who is the son of the great founding father, Roger Sherman, from Connecticut, but is famous in his own right as one of the defending attorneys in the Amistad case on behalf of the escaped slaves on that Spanish slave ship. He served alongside John Quincy Adams in that role. There's a former, very distinguished former Virginia senator, William Cabell Reeves, whose descendant is in the audience and has written his own biography of the senator. And Henry Clay's son is there, one of the great great compromiser himself, whose absence is very much felt at the Washington Peace Conference. The other characters who are on the sidelines, but very important, whom I discuss, President Buchanan, of course, soon to be out of office, but has placed all of his final hopes for saving the Union on the peace conference. His first lady, his niece, Harriet Lane, who in many ways was more successful than her her uncle in terms of keeping social, at least the social aspects of Washington together during these crisis times. General Winfield Scott, the commander of the army, who in December, seeing the crisis, has relocated himself from New York City to Washington, D.C., trying to guarantee the security of the nation's capital during the peace conference and the upcoming hoped-for inauguration of Lincoln and subsequent events. Stephen Douglas is not a delegate, the senator from Illinois, but he is a player on the sidelines. Senator Seward from New York, soon to be Secretary of State, is in town communicating with Lincoln. Vice President Breckinridge is a character in my book. The outgoing vice president, the defeated presidential candidate of 1860, soon to be Confederate general, and he will preside over the Electoral College vote, ratifying Lincoln's election during the peace conference. Charles Francis Adams is a character, the congressman from Massachusetts, who encourages his state to ignore the advice of Senator Sumner and to participate in the peace conference. Daniel Sickles, the scandalous Democratic congressman from New York, is not a delegate, but he's very much on the sidelines, and most of you know the story of at least one of his scandals. I could tell you more about other scandals, but of course, he had just 2 years before shot dead across the street from the White House his wife's lover in broad daylight, and had been acquitted. It's believed to be the first acquittal based on temporary insanity. And his lawyer was the soon-to-be War Secretary in the Lincoln administration, William Stanton. And then finally, Phineas Gurley, who is one of the many Washington pastors who are characters in my book, soon to be Lincoln's pastor. He's the Presbyterian minister, New York Avenue Presbyterian, and in fact had been his church. The F Street Presbyterian Church is where the Washington Peace Conference convenes. It had just been purchased by the Willard Hotel the year previous to be used as a conference center and theater space, and he comes back with other clergy to open up the conference every day with prayer. Well, besides the deliberations of the peace conference itself, there are obviously other multiple dramas taking place affecting the proceedings, which I describe in my book. There's lots of social life going on in Washington. Most of the congressmen from the departed seceded states have left, but replacing them are the, at least temporarily, are the peace conference delegates and those who are with them. And I include a story of a huge party that Stephen Douglas and his wife convene, inviting all the peace delegates. Reputedly, there were 400 guests there, so if that's true, it must have been a huge house. And Henry Adams, the son of Charles Francis Adams, who would go on to be the sardonic historian and social commentator, attends that party and writes in typical fashion a very sarcastic letter, I believe, to one of his brothers, describing the party, referring to Stephen Douglas as a drunk and a beast, referring to Mrs. Douglas as attractive but airheaded, sarcastically referring to John Tyler as an old fossil, and mocking the crowd that's swirling around him, attaching all their hopes to him as deluded and soon to be disappointed. His father, who lived down the street, would have his own party for the peace conference delegates a couple days later. Hopefully his review of that party was more favorable, but I couldn't find an account of that. Well, the Fort Sumter crisis is unfolding at the same time, and in fact, John Tyler, while he's in town, is also imploring James Buchanan not to inflame the situation from his perspective by reinforcing Fort Sumter. The new Confederate government convenes the same day in Montgomery, Alabama, the same day the peace conference starts, and the new flag is pulled up over the Alabama State Capitol by none other than the granddaughter of John Tyler. So their family seemed to be working at cross purposes at this point. Abraham Lincoln himself would soon be leaving Springfield several days into the peace conference, gives his famous farewell speech to the people of Springfield, saying, "I know not when or whether I shall ever see you again," and makes his slow journey through the Midwest and Northeast, saying vague, noncommittal things, but certainly being kept informed about the peace conference. As I mentioned, the Electoral College vote is soon to take place about midway through the peace conference. Typically, that's a non-event, but given how the country is falling apart based upon the election result, all kinds of rumors about how the Electoral College vote may be disrupted politically or even physically violently, and so the peace conference delegates are all invited to attend to watch that drama. Obviously, there are the plans for the upcoming inauguration and Lincoln's arrival. And then finally, a drama I described during the peace conference is the celebration of Washington's birthday. You would not think that would be controversial, but at this point in history, everything becomes controversial, and Congressman Sickles makes a motion on the House of Representatives for Washington's birthday to be celebrated in Washington with special, robust attention. Essentially, it's a sort of stick in the face of the South and to rally Northern patriotic opinion. And so there's to be a huge, by their standards, military parade in the streets of Washington on the birthday, which John Tyler finds out about to his horror the night before and sends an urgent note to President Buchanan saying this would be a great offense to the delegates from the South at the peace conference. President Buchanan, being President Buchanan, nervously cancels the parade that morning after the troops have already assembled in Pennsylvania Avenue within sight of the Willard Hotel. Congressman Sickles is disgusted, rushes to the White House, protests, saying the newspapers have already reported this parade. People have already assembled in the streets. Buchanan, again unnerved, says, "Oh, well, the parade is back on. The troops have already been returned to the barracks. They are brought back, except the Marines are too far away at their barracks in Southeast D.C., while the D.C. militia had already proceeded that morning with a parade. So there end up being two parades celebrating Washington's birthday that day in Washington. Well, I think I have 5 minutes left to cover the next 3 weeks of the Washington Peace Conference. To summarize the arguments that were made in the Willard Hotel during the 3.5 weeks of the Peace Conference, there's one school of debate put forward by, Mr. Ewing from Ohio, the old Whig, who essentially says, what the South does is not our business. I personally would not own slaves, but we should not concern ourselves with what is not our business. There's the delegate from New Jersey, Commodore Stockton, who complained. He and Ewing were two of the few Catholic delegates at the peace conference. He complains that the Republican election of 1860 had essentially been a repeat of the Puritan Revolution in 1600s Great Britain. It was an example of religious zeal that had to be resisted and suppressed, and predicted the country in the end would reject it. There's a delegate, Democrat from New York, who argues that Lincoln's election had nothing to do with slavery. It was based on other issues like the tariff, which he mentions only briefly. Mr. Baldwin from Connecticut is perhaps the most anti-slavery voice at the convention and insists on the triumph of freedom over slavery in some ultimate sense. James Seddon is the most fiery of the Southerners. He's from Virginia, and the Virginians tend to be more refined in how they express themselves, but he spends half of every year in Louisiana, where he has vast land holdings. So he is almost the only voice of the Deep South at the Washington Peace Conference, and he insists that slave owners have an intrinsic right to expand slavery into the West. And that becomes the crux issue of the Peace Conference. Will their compromise package allow for some expansion of slavery into the Western territories, which, of course, Congress, Lincoln's and the Republican Party's platform of 1860 had stipulated was unacceptable to them. So if they cross that line, that's going to add to the crisis. They're debating for several weeks, rushing forward with my few remaining minutes. Lincoln, of course, as most of you will recall, almost sneaks through Baltimore after his plane trip, after his train trip concludes through the Midwest and North, and in fear of an assassination attempt, he comes to Baltimore in the early morning hours, arrives at the Willard Hotel very early in the morning, checks in, and there's an interesting scene at the Washington, in the Peace Conference Hall, where the only mentioned slave who's actually present during the Peace Conference is a personal servant to James Seddon, and he walks in with a note, which he hands to Seddon, and someone behind him is watching this scene and can read the note, and it declares, Lincoln is in the hotel! Exclamation point, and Seddon passes the note to another Southern delegate sitting next to him, and that delegate supposedly exclaimed, Lincoln got through Baltimore? So there's an interpretation, maybe they had some insider knowledge about plots against Lincoln, but more likely it was just widely known Baltimore was a rough and difficult place, known as a mob town historically, and a place of political violence. Anyway, Lincoln later in the day sends a note to the peace delegates inviting them upstairs to meet with him. That evening, oddly, even though it's winter and they're operating by gaslight, they tend to not gather together till about noon, and they go late into the night. And so I think he summons them either at 9 or 10 o'clock. And according to one account, they proceed upstairs like animals into the ark, two by two, in a careful procession, and have a fascinating encounter, which, according to some, at least Northerners, leaves the Southern diehards rather perplexed and disheartened in that Lincoln turns out to be a more formidable character than they had anticipated. And Senator Reeves himself is said to have said at the time, according to one witness, that Lincoln may not be a George Washington or an Andrew Jackson, but he will be his own man and a force to be reckoned with. I have about 30 seconds left, probably. Well, anyway, the conference, of course, does conclude. They have a dramatic final vote. They had thought there was a fix-in on the vote, but the key controversy was over whether to expand slavery into the West. And when they vote on that, it fails. They vote by state delegations, and it fails by two states, and there's an audible gasp. Everyone is shocked. They
Spoiler alert.
And they have to adjourn, and there's heavy lobbying all night in the Willard Hotel, and the next morning it ends up passing. The proposals are approved, but they're almost dead on arrival, and I think that's largely because the Southerners at the conference, including President Tyler, were just almost shocked by the vehemence of the Northern arguments and how polarized the country had become, and realized that these proposals simply could not go anywhere. And in fact, Tyler himself, within, I believe, 48 hours, is back in Richmond to attend the secession, or the Virginia Convention debating secession, and declares the whole affair, the whole convention, whole peace conference to have been, in his words, a worthless affair. And when the proposals go to Congress, they're rejected in the Senate by 3-1, and they're essentially laughed down in the House of Representatives when Thaddeus Stevens, the abolitionist from Pennsylvania, says he agrees with John Tyler about it being a worthless affair. Ha, 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 ha. One more sentence. The Washington Peace Conference is almost typically ignored or minimized as a failure, and obviously it was in terms of not preventing the war, but Kentucky Senator John Crittenden remarked at the time that, in fact, it had played an important and even providential role during those crisis months of that winter, in that it delayed the secession of Virginia, it helped keep the border states in, it ensured Lincoln's successful arrival and inauguration, and it gave Northern opinion more time to coalesce. And I think he makes good points. Thank you.
Thanks, Mark. So our next panelist, and let's see if I can get the name of his book right. He's the author of Their Last Full Measure, The Final Days of the Civil War. He's also the author of 7 previous books and was a reporter and editor for the Associated Press for 24 years. He lives in Cary, North Carolina. Give him a round of applause, folks. It's Joseph Whelan.
Thank you very much. It's a real pleasure to be here at the Festival of the Book. My book, Their Last Full Measure, jumps ahead 4 years ahead of his book to the final 4 months of the war. And the end played out. The end of the war was messy, played out on a broad canvas from Georgia to Alabama, from the Carolinas to Richmond and Petersburg to Washington, D.C. The war's final months between January and April 1865 were marked by major events that evoked despair and jubilation. It was one of the most turbulent periods in American history. In fact, until the end of World War II, it was arguably the most turbulent 4 months that had occurred in our history. The Confederacy's last viable port, Wilmington, was shut down in January when Fort Fisher fell. And then Congress passed the 13th Amendment abolishing slavery at the end of the month. In February, General William Sherman's army marched through the Carolinas. The siege of Petersburg and Richmond ended with Union troops breaking through the rebel defenses in early April. Robert E. Lee and Joseph Johnson surrendered their armies. And then, on April 14th, President Lincoln was assassinated. Americans reeled under these events and wondered what the future held. Northerners were optimistic, Southerners were not. From the beginning of 1865, perceptive leaders in the North and South knew the war was soon to end, probably in the spring with the Union victorious. Many Confederates, including General Lee, were convinced that the war was a loss, and they wanted to negotiate peace terms. But Jefferson Davis thought victory still possible. Still, there were two brief openings for negotiated peace in February and March. In early February, three Confederate officials met with Lincoln and Secretary of State William Seward at Hampton Roads. The Southern commissioners might have been willing to concede that slavery was dead, but they could not agree to Lincoln's other condition that the South rejoin the Union. A month later, on March 3rd, Lee proposed a military peace parley with Grant. But Lincoln and War Secretary Edwin Stanton forbade Grant to meet with Lee for any purpose other than to accept his unconditional surrender. In 1865, the Confederacy remained intact in Texas, the Carolinas, the Richmond-Petersburg area, and swaths of Louisiana, Arkansas, and Alabama. Union forces held Tennessee, Georgia, most of Virginia, and large parts of the rest of the Confederacy. Both sides knew the fighting that spring would be decisive. As he had in 1864, Grant planned several simultaneous offensives so the Confederacy could not move troops from quiet sectors to threatened ones. Before the spring campaign began, the Union's first order of business was capturing Fort Fisher, North Carolina. It fell on January 15th in a combined Army-Navy operation. A month before, an attempt to capture the fort on Christmas Day of 1864 had failed, but the Union was determined to go back and close this last port where the blockade runners could land supplies. Fort Fisher's capture meant the loss of Wilmington, the last major southern seaport where these blockade runners landed food, ammunition, and weapons. Confederate Vice President Alexander Stevens called Fort Fisher's loss one of the greatest disasters which had befallen our cause since the beginning of the war. Half-starved rebel soldiers in Richmond and Petersburg now had to tighten their belts even further. On February 1st, General William Sherman began his Carolinas campaign from Savannah without waiting for spring. Confederate military leaders did not think any army could operate in South Carolina in early February, when heavy rains flooded the many rivers and swamps. Sherman was convinced that his 60,000-man army could, and it did. Sherman's men waded the swamps and rivers, corduroyed the roads with timber from the deep woods, and turned arsonist. In fact, a Confederate soldier once told his captors, he said, if your army goes to hell, you will pave it with corduroy roads, which they, it was amazing what they had done. Sherman had said that the army would turn amphibious if they had to. They pushed through South Carolina, where the war had begun, and Sherman wanted the state to feel what he called the hard hand of war. And his men destroyed railroads, looted homes, and burned public buildings in the towns. Often the entire town went up in smoke. The army lived off the land, with the foragers, or bummers, as they were called, scouring the countryside for food. At Columbia, drunken Union troops burned down half the city during the night of February 18th and 19th. It burnished Sherman's reputation as modern-day Attila. When the Union army marched out of the town, the women of Charleston booed, hissed, and spat on the Yankee troops. In Virginia, in May 1864, Lee had warned, if he were forced back into Richmond's defenses, it would become a siege, and defeat would be only a matter of time. His prophecy now unfolded. Lee's Army of Northern Virginia was the last Confederate army of any consequence, and it was in poor shape. Since June 1864, this army, which shined on the offensive, had been under siege at Petersburg and Richmond. On paper, 57,000 troops occupied the 30 miles plus of trenches and forts around the cities. In reality, there were far fewer. There were desertions every day. Across the battle lines were 124,000 Yankees, well-fed, well-supplied, in contrast to the hungry, ragged rebels. The Confederate Congress invited Lee to Richmond to discuss the Army's many problems. The congressmen said they were willing to make any sacrifice, but they proposed no action. That night, Lee returned to the family home in a black mood. Pacing his study, he said to his son, General George Washington Custis Lee, "Mr. Custis, when this war began, I was opposed to it. Bitterly opposed to it, and I told these people that unless every man should do his whole duty, they would repent, and now they will repent." The reinstated General Joseph Johnston gathered a hodgepodge army in North Carolina of more than 20,000 soldiers from the Carolinas and Mississippi. His mission was to stop Sherman before he could unite with Grant's army outside of Petersburg. At Bentonville, on March 19th, they struck Sherman's left wing. The rebels showed great spirit and drove back Sherman's men. But then Sherman's right wing arrived, and the heavily outnumbered rebels withdrew. Sherman did not pursue them, but outfitted his army in Goldsboro. He was proud of his army's 400-mile-plus march through the Carolinas. Over 50 days in the wintertime, his men had marched, had knocked the Carolinas out of the war, and punished South Carolina. At Petersburg on March 25th, Confederate General John Gordon, with Lee's blessing, attempted a breakout to join forces with Johnston's army. But Gordon's attack on Fort Stedman failed. President Lincoln toured the battlefield on horseback, visibly moved by the mangled bodies. He then met March 28th on his steamship, the River Queen, with Grant, Admiral David Porter, and Sherman, who had come up from Goldsboro. It was Lincoln's last meeting with his military leaders. Grant described his plan to flank Lee with Phil Sheridan's Cavalry Corps and two infantry corps and captured Petersburg. Lincoln spoke of his post-war plans. He intended, in his words, the most liberal and honorable terms for the South. The Union campaign south of Petersburg began March 29th. Rather than further extend his line to the west to stop Sheridan's flanking movement, Lee sent a task force under General George Pickett to defeat him. On the first day of the campaign, it rained buckets, and the roads turned into quagmires. Grant sent out an order saying he was calling off the offensive. He was going to wait till the roads dried out. When Phil Sheridan received his order, he got on his horse and rode straight to Grant's headquarters, and he talked him out of doing that. He said his army would push forward the offensive, he said, if they had to corduroy every mile of road along the way. So Grant took heart, and they pushed ahead with the offensive. On April 1st, Sheridan's cavalrymen and the 5th Infantry Corps destroyed Pickett's 11,000-man task force at Five Forks. It was the Army of the Potomac's first major victory since Gettysburg. Five Forks made Petersburg untenable for Lee's army. The all-out Union attack the next morning, April 2nd, swept through the rebel positions like a hurricane, said a Confederate officer. Lee prepared to evacuate Petersburg and told Davis that he must leave Richmond immediately. That night, the government abandoned the Confederate capital, and the city's tobacco warehouses were torched. The fire spread and gutted Richmond's business district. The next morning, Union troops entered Richmond. They put out the fires. They raised the stars and stripes over the Confederate capital. Northerners celebrated, Southerners despaired. Lee's army left Petersburg the night of April 2nd and 3rd as the townspeople wept. Grant's relentless pursuit forced the rebels to march day and night to stay ahead. The starving Confederates begged at homes for food and shot pigs, chickens, and cattle, eating the meat raw. Sheridan's men cut Lee's army in half at Sailor's Creek. 3 days later, at Appomattox Courthouse, Sheridan's troopers blocked Lee's escape route to Lynchburg. On April 9th, Palm Sunday, the remnants of General John Gordon's 2nd Corps attacked Sheridan's line. The assault ended when tens of thousands of Union infantrymen emerged from the woods behind Sheridan's men. That afternoon, Lee surrendered to Grant. The surrender took place at the home of Wilmer McLean, who ironically had moved away from Manassas at the beginning of the war after it had come under fire during the war's first battle. He wanted to get away from the war, and so he moved to Appomattox Courthouse, and the war ended in his parlor. In the spirit of Lincoln's desire for leniency, Grant allowed Confederates who owned horses to keep them to plant the year's crop. Officers could retain their sidearms. Rebels were paroled. In Richmond, people were heartbroken when they learned of Lee's surrender. A diarist wrote, "Oh, I wish we were all dead. It is as if the earth had crumbled beneath our feet." In Washington, there was jubilation and all-night celebrations and bonfires in the streets. Lincoln gave his last speech on April 11th from a second-story window of the White House. The crowd expected a triumphal recounting of Lee's surrender. Instead, Lincoln gave a policy speech, basically talking about Reconstruction. As he had written in his second inaugural address, Lincoln wished to bind up the nation's wounds and not punish the South. 3 days later, on April 14th, John Wilkes Booth shot Lincoln inside Ford's Theater in Washington. Lincoln died the next morning, the first assassinated U.S. president. Andrew Johnson was sworn in as the 17th president, while War Secretary Edwin Stanton organized a massive manhunt for Lincoln's killers. On April 26th, Johnson met with Sherman outside Durham and signed a surrender agreement modeled upon Lee's. April 26th was also when detectives and Union troopers caught up with John Wilkes Booth. He was shot to death in a barn on a northeastern Virginia farm. President Andrew Johnson had offered a $100,000 reward for Jefferson Davis's capture after it was alleged Davis was complicit in Lincoln's murder. Until his capture in Georgia in early May, Davis believed the Confederacy might yet prevail. He spoke to disbelieving aides and generals of continuing the war from Texas. But he was captured at his campsite in Georgia by Union cavalry and taken away to Fortress Monroe, Virginia, and he was imprisoned there for 2 years before his first court appearance. At that court session, he was released on bond. He was never formally charged, tried, or linked to Lincoln's assassination. Because most of the fighting had taken place in the South, it was a desolated region after the war, unlike the booming North. Towns and cities in the Army's paths had been looted and burned. Many Southerners were forced to survive on Yankee handouts. It would be a long time in coming back. Indeed, Northern leaders had brought total war to the doorsteps of ordinary Southerners in order to destroy the South's resources and sap public support. It had been an effective strategy. During the world wars of the 20th century, this strategy would be prosecuted in new, terrible ways. The Civil War marked the beginning of a new American age. In the South, General Richard Taylor, a Louisiana planter who lost everything, said abolition caused as great a change in the South as the 1789 revolution had in France. In the North, too, in the industrial North, changes amazed many. A Harvard professor wrote, "It does not seem to me as if I were living in the country in which I was born."
Thank you, Joe.
Thank you, Joe. Last but certainly not least, this distinguished gentleman sitting to my immediate left. He's the author of After the Civil War, The Heroes, Villains, Soldiers, and Civilians Who Changed America. He's the editor of A Rebel War Clerk's Diary. He's alumni, distinguished professor emeritus in history at Virginia Tech, and the author or editor of more than 20 Civil War books, including Stonewall Jackson, The Man, The Soldier, The Legend. By the way, that is the definitive biography, in my opinion, of Stonewall Jackson. Bud Robertson, everybody.
You're a nice man. Thank you. Let me start, of course, by thanking the Festival of the Book for inviting me over again. Even though I'm from Virginia Tech, I always am warmly received here in Charlottesville, and that helps immensely. I'm going to go quick because I got a full subject, and I want to leave some time for Q&A. The men who fought the Civil War also had the task of fashioning the peace that came after it. And we lost almost 1 million men in that war, but there were still 25 million people left. And where we were going after that terrible war, a war almost terrible, too terrible to define, lay in small part with the men who faced the future. This was not an original idea of mine to produce this book. The National Geographic Society came after me and asked. At first I turned them down because I just didn't see where to go. If I'm a Virginia boy. When Lee quit, I quit. As far as it. But the more I thought about it, the more intriguing it got, and I'm so glad I did it. It's the post-war careers of these people vary from exciting to bizarre what happened to them. And I'm just going to give you a rough sampling today. NGS asked me to do 70 individuals. And so the first task was, how do you turn a mob into an organized crowd? So I put them under 9 categories and went to work, and what I produced are 3, 4, 5-page essays that stressed their personality whenever possible. And I don't think I missed a one, the cause of their death. I was just interested in why these people died, and we just simply don't know. And, of course, the physicians of that day didn't know a whole lot. Walt Whitman was so atrophied and abscessed by the time he died, you could have put the cause of his death as one of 6 or 7 causes. He was just torn apart by various diseases. So we'll just go through here. The first chapter, In the Shadow of Lincoln, follows a political upheaval that's lost in American history. It was a 12-year fight. It lasted 3 times longer than the Civil War, and it was fought over control of the government and the Union. You have to look at the situation moment after Lincoln's death. The only friend the defeated South had was Lincoln, and he's dead. The mantle then falls to Andrew Johnson, a Democrat in a Republican government, a man unliked by everybody, no exception. So that left you to fall back on the Secretary of State. But William Seward had been grievously wounded in the Lincoln assassination attempt. And so almost by elimination or by arrogance, it was Secretary of War Edwin Stanton who grabbed the reins of leadership. Nobody opposed him. And Stanton, in concert with House Leader Thaddeus Stevens and Senate Leader Charles Sumner, created the Radical Republican Bloc. And basically what they wanted was not reconciliation. They want retribution. They want the South to pay for its sins. As an aside, the Radical Republicans will quickly disregard all the promises they made to the blacks. And so the slaves will be free, but they will be shoved to the side. The 13th Amendment frees them, but we're still trying to implement the 14th and 15th Amendments. The road to equality, the Radical Republicans really didn't care a hoot about. And so they get into this big fight. Very quickly, you know, it ends up with Andrew Johnson being impeached. The hatred became so strong that the South was a Democratic stronghold until well into the administration of Franklin D. Roosevelt. You just did not vote for a Republican in the South after Radical Reconstruction takes over. So I talk about Stanton and Stevens and Sumner and Seward and Salmon P. Chase, who lusted for the White House and never got it. I also have a chapter to the only American of that era who was legally lynched by the victorious Union, and that was Henry Wirz, who commanded Andersonville. And I think he was railroaded to the gallows in one of the great injustices in American history. And then the second chapter deals with when Johnny comes marching home again, and I take about a dozen Southerners and follow their careers. Of course, on the negative side, Longstreet and Mosby broke all 10 commandments by joining the Republican Party immediately after the war, and that put them on the negative side. It was open season on both. Mosby actually left the country. He was so fed up with his own South. But Robert E. Lee becomes the greatest reconciler of the post-war South. I would strongly assert that no man in America worked harder to bring North and South back together again than did Lee. But he had only 5 years in which to do it. In March 1863, just before Chancellorsville, Lee suffered a major heart attack. I've conferred with several physicians on it. A major heart attack. And what did they do for him? Nothing. The field of cardiology lay in the future. So Lee is ill. He's ill at the time of Appomattox. And his health will slowly deteriorate until arteriosclerosis finally takes him. But Lee will be the great reconciliator throughout all of this. George Pickett, a classic example of a man who just went down. After his charge at Gettysburg, which was incidentally the only notable thing George Pickett ever did, and he lost that. After the charge at Gettysburg, he blamed Lee for it. And in blaming Lee for his own incompetence, Pickett laid the door wide open for his own exile, you might say, from the South. But there's a wonderful story they tell. Late in the 1860s, a group of Confederate generals met in one of the men's clubs in Richmond, and they all began sipping sauce, and everybody got a little loaded. And then they got into the proverbial argument of who lost the Battle of Gettysburg. And then they started arguing. Was it Stuart's absence? Ewell's failure to attack on the first day, Longstreet's hesitation on the second day. And they were going at it, and one of them spied Pickett over in the corner. And he hollered over, "Pickett, to what do you describe our loss at Gettysburg?" And Pickett, who was about half bummed himself, replied, "Well, the Union Army had a hell of a lot to do with it." And I think that's one of the most profound statements George Pickett ever made. I love Francis Nichols, too. That's a great story. He was a Louisiana colonel who came east with his regiment. His first battle was the Battle of Kernstown, March 1862. He gets his left foot shot off. He goes back to Louisiana, gets mended, comes back. His second battle is the Battle of Chancellorsville. He gets his left arm shot off. And he goes back to Louisiana, and he lives it out. And in 1877, with the erasure of Reconstruction, the Democratic Party came back into service. And they decided to run Nichols for governor. On a wonderful platform, "We are running all that is left of General Nichols." And he won a landslide. He even served a long term on the state Supreme Court. There's a chapter on the first modern war and the men who created these innovations, who hurled America and the world into a new military age. Of course, William T. Sherman, not merely the father of the Urban Renewal Program, but Sherman's concept of total warfare. You have to take the war to the people to break their will, not merely defeat their armies. But it was Bedford Forrest who initiated what the Germans called blitzkrieg tactics, dashing quickly to take a target and backing away to safety. It was Christopher Spencer invents the seven-shot carbine. A fellow named Richard Gatlin got the idea of creating a weapon so deadly that it would have put an end to all thoughts of war, and invented the Gatling gun, which was just full of errors. They couldn't get it up perfected. They got it up to some level in the Austro-Prussian War a little later, but it really came into effect when we exterminated the Indians in the West, and the Gatling gun was a favorite weapon to use then. There was a young man from Staten named James Hanger, and at 18, in one of the first skirmishes of the war, he lost his leg. And he came home, and the peg leg he received just didn't fit well. And Hanger, who was kind of a carpenter by trade, fashioned his own artificial limb. And to fast forward from this 19-year-old's effort came Hanger Prosthetics International. It's the largest artificial limb company in the world. They make 700,000 artificial limbs per year. It all started from a kid in Staten who just didn't like the way that keg leg looked and it felt. If you're interested in medicine, an angel comes out of that war. His name was Jonathan Letterman. And he took military medicine, given the job of medical director of the Army of the Potomac, and he revolutionized the field. I can't go through everything that he did. I don't have time. He instituted ambulances. He instituted personal medical records. You go to see a physician, he comes in the door, and he's got your file on his arm. That didn't exist until Letterman. He initiated quick removal of the wounded from the field. He initiated a series of first aid stations, the battlefield first aid, then the field hospital, then the general hospital. He prioritized injuries. You didn't take the man in the orders in which they brought in. You took them in the order of the seriousness of their wound. And to kind of give you two summations of what Jonathan Letterman did. In 1945, General Paul Hawley, who was Eisenhower's chief medical officer in the European Theater of Operations, confessed, "Every day of this war, I have thanked God for Jonathan Letterman." And he literally saved thousands of lives, and he lives on today. If you have an accident and call 911, you're calling Jonathan Letterman. He set up the emergency treatment of sinners, which we have. So that chapter of the first is great. One not many of you will enjoy, but I did. I worked myself through graduate school in the funeral business in Atlanta. And I had to have Thomas Holmes in there. You never heard of Thomas Holmes. He invented embalming fluid. He was the first man to conceive of arterial injection for preservation. Now, he was a cuckoo. He was just a real cuckoo. He loved cadavers. He had him in his house, standing up in the corner, sitting in a chair. All of it. He'd been kicked out of Columbia Medical School because he put a cadaver on his professor's desk. But it was Holmes who had this passion for dead bodies who created embalming fluid. and the entire funeral business today is his offspring. He made a fortune in the process, I might add. I do pay attention to the fine arts. I talk about Louisa May Alcott, poor Walt Whitman, who was going to resume his greatness, but a stroke in 1873 took most of the fire out of him. But he still remained America's greatest poet, greatest spokesman for the common people. Matthew Brady, so myopic that he couldn't see 10 feet away. He went out to film the first Battle of Manassas, got lost in the woods, and they found him 2 days later, still wandering in the woods. He couldn't find out where he was in the midst of this opening battle. It's Alexander Gardner, one of his assistants, who took most of the battlefield photograph. Brady made a fortune. He died homeless on the streets of New York and was buried in an unmarked grave for 20 years. Winslow Homer got his lead there. Alfred Wilde drew his first battle sketches in this war. George Frederick Root wrote 34 songs, about half of which are still basic parts of American patriotism. And then there is, of course, my favorite, Thomas Nast. Nast was the first editorial page cartoonist. He's the father of editorial page cartoonists. His pen was so vicious that it is said the adjective nasty refers to him. But there's another side to Nast, which you recognize and adore once a year. He's not remembered as much as the father of editorial page cartoons as he is the man who gave us Santa Claus. He drew the first Santa Claus. And that's ours. We don't have an import, St. Nicholas or Kris Kringle. Santa Claus is all American, and it was given to us by this German immigrant. Of course, I had to devote a section to the West. 4,000 square miles of land lay open for the taking after the Civil War. And it was one of the leading items on the national headlines for at least three decades. And you start with, please excuse me, I've got a terrible cold of getting over it. You start with Grenville Dodge, who was the chief engineer for the Transcontinental Railroad, which once it linked East and West together, opened up the entire area for settlement. You have to mention George Armstrong, Custer, idiot that he was. But Custer was always glory-seeking and foolhardy, especially after the war, when suddenly his brevet major general rank slipped back to lieutenant colonel. And Custer wanted his stars back, and he tried to get them by killing Indians. And on June 25th, 1876, he was to attack an Indian village. And he would be in the center column with two support columns. And Custer got in position, he got impatient, failed to wait for his support, and attacked straight ahead with 247 men. He expected to find a couple of hundred Indians. He found 2,000 Sioux and Cheyenne waiting for him. And what ensued was simply a slaughter. I know many of you have seen dramatic paintings of Custer's last stand. They're not true. There was no last stand. It was a running fight for your life. And National Geographic archaeologists have surveyed the area, and they found bodies and remains stretching over 4.5 miles, which means these men of the Southern Cavalry were fleeing for their lives, and the Indians are pouring all over them, killing everyone. 247 men were killed. 246 horses were killed. One horse survived, quote, Custer's last stand. But the news of his death by Indians reached the East Coast on July 4th, 1876, the centennial of our birth. And the American media politely twisted the facts a little bit. You'd be surprised, they can do that on occasion. They twisted the little facts from them, and suddenly it's a second crucifixion. Custer had given his life to savages in defense of his country. And he's been a martyr ever since. He was foolhardy. Sherman and Grant both said, had he lived, they would have court-martialed him and sent him home in disgrace. But it is Custer's last stand that inspires Americans to the belief, to the conclusion, we got to eliminate Native Americans. And so the settlement of the West represents America's most shameful hour. We went out and we exterminated a race. We killed the buffalo to starve them to death, and those whom we didn't starve, we shot until the West was open for settlement. And you have to point a strong finger of guilt toward Philip Sheridan, a great general in the Civil War, but a man notorious for having said the only good Indian is a dead Indian. And Sheridan practiced that throughout. I do devote a chapter to Wild Bill Hickok simply to show the absurdity of American myth-making. You know, these gunslingers, so to speak, were anything but gunslingers out in the West. They were mostly criminals who had themselves shot the sheriff or something. They become sheriff of a town, and they are the judge, the jury, and the executioner. They might catch a horse thief in the morning, tell him riding into town you're guilty, and hang him that afternoon. Justice was swift. And these guys were quick with the guns because they're creating civilization out of a wild frontier. And they were not very good shots. I grew up a great fan of Gunsmoke and always just used to love to see Matt Dillon in the middle of the street going for his gun when the other guy went for his. And it was terrible to do research on this book and find out how it was. These guys couldn't hit the side of a barn when they were shooting. Secondly, you never had a face-out. Somebody's going to get hurt if you have a face-off. They relied on ambush. They shot you from behind. Hid behind a barrel or a fence and shot you when you were walking down the street. Wild Bill Hickok was shot in the back of the head while he was playing poker. And so just get this gunslinger myth out of your mind. These guys were the necessary intermediary between civilization and anarchy from which they came. I then have a chapter on the generals who tried to do things and it just didn't work out. Men like Farragut, Hooker, Meade, Thomas, all famous names, but they just didn't seem to go anywhere. Meade especially was quick out. He died in 1870 of pneumonia. And then there were the politicians, and you know the old saying, every general is a good politician, which is absolutely absurd. But George B. McClellan went from failing in command of the Army of the Potomac to a presidential nominee in 1864. He failed at that as well. But there were some like Burnside, Ambrose Burnside, and Lawrence Chamberlain, who made successful career. And then there were those like Dan Sickles and Judson Kilpatrick and Benjamin Franklin Butler, who were embarrassing in American politics, riding their wartime reputations in a highly negative way. Butler changed political parties, I think. Oh, no, that was Nathaniel Banks, who changed political parties 7 times. And his age, like to say, showed how flexible he was in dealing with politics. And then 5 of these men of the Union who were officers become president of the United States. 5 of them. And 2 of them are assassinated. You and I know a whole lot about Kennedy and Lincoln, but I suspect we know very little about Garfield and McKinley. Indeed, Bill McKinley, William McKinley, was probably the most popular president of his day of any leader we've had in the White House. Everybody loved Big Bill McKinley. He was amiable, a loving father, a wonderful husband. His wife suffered from epilepsy, and at state dinners he had Ida sitting to his right rather than at the end of the table so that if she went through a grand mal seizure, McKinley would kindly lean over and place the napkin over her face and continue the conversation. And once the upper leg of seizure was over, he would quietly pull the handkerchief back and go about his way. You don't find political leaders like that anymore. There was no reason to... I'm being a historian with a light touch right at the moment. There was no reason to kill him. And Leon Czolgosz, who shot him, was an anarchist who believed that there are too many rich people, too many poor people, and too many rich people were exploiting them. If he killed the leader of the rich people, it would be a blow. And the reaction to McKinley's assassination was tremendous. Mobs tried to kill Czolgosz twice before he went on trial. And once he was convicted and condemned to die, they decided to use a brand new experiment, and I suspect the authorities hoped it wouldn't work. But in any event, Czolgosz was put to death by the novel form of electrocution. And after he was taken from the electric chair and his body was placed in a coffin, the prison warden poured a gallon of sulfuric acid into the coffin to accelerate decomposition so Czolgosz would disappear from the world altogether. And so it's just a kind of a crazy, crazy thing going on there in political leadership. We don't get the great presidents. McKinley is about the only one in that 1965 to 1900, who has demonstrates great ability. Of course, Garfield only served 4 months. And then, of course, the last chapter has to be the rising of America as we know it. We were just a struggling nation in 1860. The Industrial Revolution had just taken root, and indeed it will be a powerful factor in Union victory in the Civil War. But in this post-war period, we will go from a beginner until by 1900 we are the most powerful industrial nation on earth. And so you have to look at men like Andrew Carnegie, John D. Rockefeller in oil, Carnegie in steel, Jay Gould in railroads, J.P. Morgan in banking, all of these fellows building up their empires. Philip Armour, for example, in canned meat. And it ended up, not only did Armour produce a lot of pig meat, he found that much of the rest of the pig was useful. And he produced fertilizer, buttons, and every other thing. Armour used to like to boast, "I get money out of everything but the squeal," where that pig was concerned. But they all come up and turn America into an industrial empire. So these post-war leaders and what they did may sound a bit inconsequential, but you must remember the America you live in, the America we know, was born in 1865, not 1787. You live in a land that was carved and fashioned by what took place on the battlefield. And as I told the panel yesterday, that war affects you so much, you can't escape it. You cannot escape what the Civil War does. It opened up, for a quick example, pre-size clothing. Every piece of clothing you have on was made before you got into it. That was unheard of. Montgomery Meigs, the Quartermaster General of the Union Army, was the man who invented small, medium, large, and extra large. When public grief at post offices became so overwhelming because women were getting that inevitable letter that a loved one was not coming home, the local post office got the reputation as a wailing wall. And the post office department said, "We've got to do something to get out of this." So in 1864, the Postal Service came up with something new: home delivery of mail. And so that mailbox sitting by your door, or that mailbox on that post at your curbing, is really not just a mailbox. It's a memorial to a Civil War soldier who didn't come home. The Civil War is your war. It's our war. It's a war we literally and simply cannot forget. Thank you.
We'd love to take some questions. Okay. Yes.
Since we're in the middle of our second Civil War, and I'm pushing the envelope a little bit, but it's a Cold War, but we have some civil issues. What do you attribute the interest in the Civil War 150 years afterwards? And I'm asking all three of you.
Anybody want? Okay. A number of things. We are not England. We have no state family. We have no state church. We have no aristocracy, so to speak. Really, the only thing you and I have in common, basically, is our history. And here in Virginia, I know we have history like nobody else. And I realize I talk too much about history, perhaps. But as I tell people, we've got more of it than you do. So, I need to talk about it. You know, we were celebrating Thanksgiving while the pilgrims were still trying to get up courage to get on the boat and come over to New England. So, you know, our history goes back so far. And it's the history that binds us together. Moreover, it's our war. It's not us against them. It's us against us. And if you look at what we got out of that war, you should take common pride and courage and patriotism. And whatever happens, whether it be federal soldiers perishing at Fredericksburg or Confederate soldiers dying at Gettysburg, they were us. They were dying for us to create a nation, which the politicians couldn't do. The Civil War comes because politics fail, and the soldier had to take command. It is a classic example of what happens when this nation loses the only thing we have to hold it together, namely a spirit of compromise. When we can't agree verbally and politically, democracy is in crisis. I think we're in crisis now.
We'd like to take some more questions. I've got a bunch if y'all don't have any questions. Mark, tell us why Tyler was called his accidency.
Yes, I didn't have time to get into that, but he was the first president to take office by virtue of the death of his predecessor, William Henry Harrison, who died very early in his term and had been the oldest man elected to the presidency. Interestingly, John Tyler supposedly got the news of Harrison's death and took the oath of office in Brown's Hotel on Pennsylvania Avenue, which became his favorite hotel, where he also stayed during the Washington Peace Conference.
And he and Harrison were from the same county in Virginia. When would that ever happen again?
That's right.
In American politics,
they were neighbors for Berkeley Plantation,
right,
and Sherwood Forest.
Right. Question from the audience. Joe, aside from the obvious things, the lack of finding supplies at Amelia when Robert E. Lee and the Army of Northern Virginia are marching through, and aside from getting surrounded on three sides at Appomattox, is Sailor's Creek, in your estimation, the biggest disaster, the main reason for the surrender?
Oh, I think so. Yeah, that was the major defeat on that long retreat, week-long retreat. The Army was cut in half. In fact, Lee saw them coming, the survivors coming up the hill toward him, and he said, "My God, has the Army been dissolved?" And it looked like it was going to be the end fairly soon after that, and it was just about 3 days later.
Right.
So, yeah, that was the key battle, and that was Phil Sheridan with his cavalry getting ahead, riding ahead, and trying to cut off the Army. And what had happened was that Longstreet, his corps, had gotten too far ahead of the rest of the Army and created this gap. And it was George Custer's cavalry unit that filled that gap, and then other cavalry units came in, and then the 6th Army Corps came up behind them, and they captured a lot of Confederates that day.
Yep. Bud, we talked about this earlier at breakfast. You included one of my favorite people of all time, Christopher Spencer. Tell us a little bit more about Mr. Spencer.
He was just a gunmaker. He just got this idea that surely there had to be a better way to invent a shoulder arm than the laborious process of loading all the pallet of bullets, the cap and everything into a musket. And so he designed this 7-shot repeater, repeating gun, in which the bullets were stored in the barrel and fed in. And all you had to do was fire and cock, fire and cock. And the Confederates called it a weak gun, W-double-E-K, claiming that the damn Yankees could fire on a Sunday and keep firing it for a week. I think you see the most effective use of the Spencer on July 1, 1863, when John Buford's cavalry hurled back an entire two divisions of Confederates, a handful of Union cavalry, and they were using Spencers. Now, from that, if you're not familiar with a Spencer, its son would be the old Winchester carbine and the Henry carbine, all come after it. And the development of armament always infatuated Lincoln. He was always looking for new things and new ways. And Spencer actually put on two demonstrations for Lincoln, and it was Lincoln who rubber-stamped the first production of the Spencer when the old fogies in the War Department said, "Oh, it's too new, it's too untested, it won't work." Well, and Lincoln, of course, was much more far-sighted than them. I think Richard Gatling, though, really takes the case. He wanted to invent something so awesome that a man just wouldn't want to go to war because of it, and he invented this Gatling gun. And it lives today. Those many of you know about war know that one of the most potent airplanes we have is the A-10 Warthog. And it carries a Gatling gun. And try to imagine this, if you will. That gun can fire 2,900 rounds a minute. I mean, it will level everything in there with that rotating gun barrel it has. So Gatling did indeed invent a very awesome weapon, but it just was not perfected at the time of the war.
Yeah. There we go. Now we got some questions.
Yeah, now we'll go.
Yes, sir. And here comes the microphone for you.
you spoke of Robert E. Lee as being, or someone spoke of him as being a peacemaker after the war. I heard a story that after the conclusion of the war, Lee was in a church service in Richmond.
St. Paul's.
And a black man walked in at the communion ceremony, and the congregation was aghast. Lee stood up, walked up, and knelt down next to him. Mm-hmm. Is that?
That's true.
Okay.
Normally at St. Paul's, the blacks sat in the gallery, and they took communion lastly. The white folks on the main floor took communion first. But when Reverend Minigerode asked the faithful to come forward and receive communion, this well-dressed black man came sliding right down the aisle and knelt, and the whole congregation just froze. But Lee stepped out of his pew, went up and knelt beside him, and that started it. And that was just one of many, many acts that Lee would do. What he gave to Washington College is just unbelievable. Lee is the father of elective courses in American higher education. Mm. He's the father of the honor system, followed by most colleges and universities. And in 1868, Horace Greeley, editor of the New York Tribune, the largest newspaper in the North, nominated Lee for president. He and the Tribune endorsed Robert E. Lee to be president of the United States, 1868. And the irony is, had Lee won, he couldn't have served. He was not a citizen. His citizenship had been taken away. And in fact, the petition for amnesty was lost. And it came to light in the summer of 1965.
Right.
And it was Gerald Ford who finally signed the amnesty, and Lee received citizenship posthumously. I like to think of it as a Purple Heart rather than simply a piece of paper.
So Lee almost became the father of non-citizens running for president in the United States.
Dr. Robertson, I agree with you that our country is in crisis, and I would like to know what you think that the average citizen can do to make a difference about that.
The average citizen?
Yes, sir.
You mean in voting?
I'm not sure voting's making a difference.
Let's take voting. I can give you a very simple thing to that. I tell audiences, particularly this year, you don't realize how powerful your vote is. I mean, you're just locked into apathy. You don't realize how powerful your vote is. Let's start with just a simple statement. In a presidential election, 40% of the people vote. Let me put it another way. In a presidential election, 3 out of 5 Americans don't care. They don't bother to vote. 3 out of 5. Now, if you just got 1 of those 3, maybe 2, you can change the country. You voted those folks in, you can vote them out. As simple as that. You just got to vote. And we don't exercise it. And we'll never, and things are not going to improve as long as you sit and watching Fox News saying, oh, this is awful, this is awful. You've got to get up and do something about it. And the vote is the only thing you have. It's the most powerful instrument in this country. Remember, 40%. 40%.
One more. Barkley.
I was educated in the Virginia school system, and so my assessment of Reconstruction is about what you were talking about. Although lately there was a book, Redemption, by Nicholas Lemon, and I've heard some other historians talking, reassessing Reconstruction as maybe there were some positive aspects to it, that there was enfranchisement and educating the freed men and women, that there were some positive aims. Do you think that do those reassessments hold any water with you?
Well, I think you can always find qualitative and quantitative differences in it, but historians will always argue over Reconstruction, and Southern historians have the worst of it because we're coming from behind. You know, in a war, the winners are the one who writes the first history. And then you play catch-up with the losers. But again, you have to remember, winners of a war easily forget. Losers of a war never do. And that explains much of the ongoing interest or perhaps resentment of the South. I've long felt the bitterness that may exist in the South came more from Reconstruction. After all, for 4 years, the Confederacy was a miracle. Not merely on the battlefield, But especially when you look behind the lines, and this is J.B. Jones points out in his diary, forget this Moonlight Magnolia vision of the Southern Confederacy. It was born in chaos, and it died in absolute confusion out of control. J.B. Jones himself, the author of this diary, will die of tuberculosis, contracted in the filth and the hunger and the shoddiness of Richmond, which in 1860 had 38,000 people. In 1863, that's 300,000. And there's no more food for the 300,000 than there was for the 38,000 in 1860. People are starving to death. The government of the Confederacy gets a lot of study because it's a shining example of incompetence from top to bottom. Nobody trusts anybody else. And Jefferson Davis' greatness, if there be greatness, and I think there is to a degree, lies in the fact he was a great dreamer. He was like John Kennedy. He had great visions of the future, but he was lost to reality. Just lost to reality. And so as John B. Jones's diary gets more and more bitter because he sees the government falling apart and he's helpless to do anything about it. I do recommend that diary to you. If you're a Seward student, it's the biggest diary in American history, certainly the largest for Civil War history. And this guy was in his 50s. He never missed a thing. He was a journalist by trade. He saw everything. He heard everything. He wrote everything down. He had to be a supervisor in the War Department. He didn't have enough time to do a lot of work there. He's working so much on his diary. I have to think that. And speaking of books, finally, the university bookstore goofed. They sent the wrong book over here. The Untold Civil War is the one I did 4 years ago for National Geographic. Some of you, I think, already have bought After the Civil War elsewhere. It's in a white dust jacket. I'm sorry, it's not my fault, but I'm sorry. I hope you will get it. I think you will find some of those 70 figures absolutely fascinating. I certainly did.
Well, folks, I want to cut it short here because these gentlemen have books to sell, and even though you don't have your current book, this is a great book, too. Let's give them a hand, everybody.
Thank you.